Hello. Welcome to Pat's Labor, a podcast about the anime Pat Labor and Pat's Labor to learn about labor history through the prism of Pat's Labor. My name is Tucson Egan.
And that's Pat over there.
And this is Clayton. Somewhere.
I couldn't let it be too perfect. I just had to throw a wrench in it. Somehow.
Why did you switch? You're pointing to things, and I'm just like, you don't know the format's going to look like.
They'll know what the bonus video podcast.
All right.
When Alexander wept because there were no more kingdoms to conquer, he should have maybe fucked up conquering some of the kingdoms so that he could have something to do tomorrow.
Pat, that's not how the quote goes. Didn't you watch Westworld? That's a corruption of a Plutarch quote. It's not that he wept because he had no more kingdoms to conquer. It's that when Alexander learned of an infinity of worlds, he wept because he had yet to conquer even one.
Wow, get wrecked, Alexander.
Yeah, it's
damn.
True. It's true.
I've learned something already. We just started.
I literally just learned that from an episode of Pat's Labor. It's funny I mentioned that because I actually do have, of all things, a copy of Plutarch's Lives on my on my desk because I'm just, the world's got me feeling kind of philosophical lately. So I figured, I might as well just start reading this shit. I'm like, I don't know. It's like, get it in before it's over. I don't know. Whatever. Anyway.
And you know what? Speaking of, at first I thought this was not at all a philosophical episode of Pat Labor. And then at the very end.
Oh, yes, it is.
I was kind of like, and I'm wondering, we'll get to that. It's kind of my favorite thing about this episode, but we'll get to that last part. What did you all just overall think of this one?
Oh my God, this episode whips. I did not think this was going to be what it was. I thought it was going to be like descending action from the whole JSDF like attempted coup, but no, they're right? Like, nah, we're going to get this one right under the belt. Right under the belt. It's so damn well paced and it's so exciting and there's a mystery and there's tension and there's stakes and like, oh my goodness. Like, I loved it. Sorry.
And yet like all Pat Labor, it extremely sparing use of the labors.
Yes.
The robots themselves. Mm-hmm. But even in the film format, you might think that like, okay, now this is the movie. They got the animation budget. They're going to have a bunch of robot fight scenes. It's like, no, we're still going to find a way to make this mecha anime really interesting without just banging the robots against each other.
Right.
Now, wait, hold on a sec. Did you say movie, Pat? Did you watch the first movie? Did you know there was another episode of the OVA?
That's amazing. If we look.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Pat's Labor. Welcome back to the beginning of the episode. Nothing happened before this.
Everything's fine. It was simultaneous, and we are here to talk about the last episode of the Pat Labor OVA.
The early years,
the title of this episode, which now escapes me, I believe it has something to do
with SV units go north.
SV units go north. At first I thought it was SV units roll out, and I was just like, that's the wrong show. We're not talking about that right now.
I mean, we do have a lot of lovely shots of a 18-wheeler in this episode.
I was going to say, actually, was Optimus here the whole time?
Can you imagine what Pat Labor would be like if there were Transformers in there too? Man, that'd be fucking cool. Anyway.
Can you imagine all the scenes of them being like, we're over our transformation budget for this month, so don't turn into a robot. Just be a normal car.
Yeah. Optimus has to just be like a fire truck for like an entire episode, like two episodes. It can't do shit.
Multi-episode arc about him having to just get his pump engine maintenance done the guys who are supposed to clean out my pumps are running late because there's traffic in the city, so my pump maintenance is behind, so I can't go out. Sorry guys.
All life forms deserve to file form 791.
Oh my god.
Episode 7.
Yes.
SV units go north. I think I asked this. What did you all think of this one?
Oh my God, this episode is so fucking good.
This episode rocks.
It's so good. It's like they snuck it out just under the finish line. They were just like, you go for the entire OVA, and it's like this sort of procedural, like real mecha, capital R, capital M mecha, where we're talking about all the stakes, and there's like this interpersonal drama and all this stuff. And that's still apparent here too, but it's just like, you know what? You've been so patient through these 6 past episodes, and I know we had a lot of fun adventures, but you know what? I'm going to give you this one episode where there is an actual fucking mech fight, and it whips.
Yeah.
Like, and everything before that whips, too.
I don't disagree with any of that. There's this part of me that's like, why was this one last?
I also wondered that. Yeah.
I could have seen it fit perfectly fine before the doubleheader. This one in a way feels out of time. Like it feels like this could have taken place any time in that sort of like first, not maybe right when they got started, because they weren't this all together, but like any of that 9 months that took place between the beginning of the series and when there's a coup that they just don't talk about at all in this one. But you know, maybe that's how it would be.
Right.
I'm genuinely so curious about what their rationale was with the order of this, because I completely agree with everything that you said. There's one interpretation of it, which is that they had done the biggest, most ambitious arc they had, and then they just wanted to do an episode where they had a lot of fun. Or then there's the there's also maybe an interpretation where, like, at some point somebody in the studio is like, shit, we need an episode with some robot action in it.
Yes,
so that, like, it goes into production late and then they release it. So they have one episode where a robot punches a robot.
Yeah.
Yeah, or a couple robots.
I think, you know, I think I mentioned at the top that I did rewatch the Pat Labor movie, like, along with rewatching this episode, like, back to back with one another. And I think, and we're not talking about the Pat Labor movie yet. No. We're not talking about that yet.
Sorry.
But I think that the reason why they chose to do this episode last is because of its, the previous two episodes were kind of like a peak for the entire OVA. They were sort of all like, in one way or another, leading up to this sort of like, this climax. And this is sort of the descending action for them to go back to the sort of status quo, so that when they do enter to where they enter with the Pat Labor movie, then it's just like, you know, this is just average, everyday sort of stuff. If they cut this episode and we went from the last episode for the coup, and then we just went straight into the Pat Labor movie, it would be even more whiplash than compared to this one. So you have to have this one nestled in there.
A little reset, kind of.
Right, a little bit of reset. I'm just like, yeah, that was some crazy shit we dealt with like a couple months ago, right? Yeah.
Yeah,
but
basically.
You know what? Same shit, different day, man. It's like, just keep on going.
It even starts differently.
Mm-hmm.
Where we just get the like cold open, nighttime, somewhere.
We don't get the title card until the very last shot of the episode.
And it's a non-traditional title card.
Yeah,
so it's a gas station. We realize it's a gas station for truckers.
Mm-hmm.
Then a truck is stolen, some guy. And it's interesting. The scene, it sets things, the tone off in an interesting way, because he's stolen and he's yelling at the gas attendant, someone stole my truck. And then a police officer in a bike rides up. What's going on here? And the gas attendant's like, this dude's truck was just stolen. And the guy's like, actually, no, don't worry about it. You know, forget it. I never had a truck. Goodbye. And he tries to run away.
Yeah, I love that.
Like, oh, you're one of those criminal elements, aren't you? Like, this dude just got stolen from, and then he just like tried to cover it up.
It's such a fun opening for the episode. And then immediately after that, we get introduced to the musical theme of the episode, and it's so good.
Is that was it with the glowing Pat Labor logo?
Yes.
Because that was the distinct title in this one. Mm-hmm. So you got like a neon Pat Labor logo.
Mm-hmm. And you got a fucking 18-wheeler ripping down the highway and like awesome like 1980s, early 90s, just like gung guitar going and a saxophone just wailing.
Oh, man.
Really good. And that first shot of the 18-wheeler moving down the highway is such – it's another one of their like huge flex shots, right? Because it's like
– Yeah.
It's a – you know, it's a 2D illustration of a truck, but they're doing 3D movement around this truck, and it looks so believable and big and cool.
And they did it by hand. They did that shit by hand because they had no other choice.
It's like funny you say it's a flex, but it's like, yeah, compared to some of the scenes where they're meticulously animating a robot, they're doing it for a semi truck. They're making like a semi truck look sick as. And the thing is we're going to see soon, like, this is the main, like, location of the episode. Is like, it's a highway, but it's kind of like this truck, maybe main character is like this truck. The pilot of it doesn't actually matter right away. In fact, that's what this whole intro is sort of about, is that, like, a truck gets stolen. But why wouldn't the truck driver want to say it was stolen to a cop? Okay. Now we're into, like, what does SV2 have to do with this? And I'm trying to remember why I wrote this here, but it's National Safety Week, apparently.
That's right, yes. Yeah, the SV2 is playing hooky from some sort of parade or official grandstanding to be on the case of this missing truck because they got a tip from a beach house sympathizer, which is the eco-terrorist organization that they've been having run-ins over the course of the series. That this hijacking was either about just the truck. Did they know the hijacking was happening, or were they expecting the truck before it got hijacked?
I thought the guy who got arrested by the cop, he was the beach house member who, like, just narked and just said, yeah, that truck's got something that we stole and now it's off in the wind and we don't know where it is. So then
I don't know who stole it or why, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
It was double. Yeah, I wrote it's double stolen. and they talk about how there's a demo labor on the truck, which is cool because that's another type of labor we've got now. There are construction, deconstruction, police, military.
Yeah.
I don't know if we've got any other confirmed. Whatever that weird one, maybe that weird three-legged one in the first episode was a construction labor. But yeah, for the most part,
I think
they say they use them for everything. We haven't seen them actually used for all that much.
Right. Yes, so we've got an 18-wheeler moving down the highway with a stolen labor in it. We don't know the motivations of the driver. And this episode sort of kicks off with the efforts of SV2 to control the situation. One of the bits that I really liked that really felt in line with Godot. Sorry, what's the name of the commander of SV2?
SV2 or SV1?
SV2.
SV2? Godot.
Yeah.
Godot. So Godot's cruising down the highway and he reaches a police checkpoint put up by one of the local prefectures. And there's this really wonderful scene where he's like, wow, this is a really impressive blockade you guys have here. And, like, good job getting this up so quickly. I'm sorry, but can you take it down? And then he goes through his rationale with the local police, which is that, like, if this guy who is driving a stolen vehicle with a labor in it is provoked or scared, he's likely going to start using this labor, which is an extremely destructive thing. And if he does that, we want him to do it here on the highway, not in your local towns, your local streets, like places where people live. They're explicitly trying not to spook him to the point where he bails off the highway and then gets in this thing. They're trying to keep him on the highway to settle it on the highway. And it reminds me so much of just, like, the theme of, I mean, this has been the theme of so much of the show so far.
It's great because this is, like, Superintendent Kuzumoto he's on point. He's doing his job. And Godot's like, can you not?
Do less.
Do less.
I need you to do less. You see my team? I need you to be like them. Do less.
And yeah. I think he may even say that, like, first of all, it's easier to just know where he's going if he's on the major highways.
Yeah.
So we don't want him to get, like, into an off-road. It's harder to know where he might go from that point. But also, he's got a labor back there. We don't want him to broke enough that he uses it. So it's like, I feel like he says there's kind of, like, multiple reasons. It's just better if we keep him on the highway. And which turns out to be true, because I think the guy does pull up. They, like, said he's on an off road for a while. And I think he gets back on it. But, like,
that's
while
right.
This is, like, they're kind of, like, I think they're falling by helicopter. They're not, like, totally lost, but they start to put together their own plan. He's like, okay, take this down so we can get our own plan underway. And they're not, again, revealing it to us, the audience. But I noted something here when he's talking to, I think it's Nagumo. I didn't write down exactly who says it, but somebody mentions the communist bloc.
That's right.
And it did. It was the first time I feel like we mentioned communists, which I just thought was interesting because this is made still when the USSR existed.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Right next to Japan. I mean, it's like it's not. It's a little more interesting just to see like how a Japanese show considers that.
This episode, I believe, was released June 25th, 1989. So this is before the Soviet Union fell. So their vision of the future of a 1998 is one in which the USSR still exists. So that's very interesting.
I'm trying to remember if this had to do with like who made the labor or
is the labor is West German, I think.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
So I don't. So
because there was some stuff about smuggling. Maybe we haven't got. I'm jumping the gun on this, but there's some stuff about like how you're supposed to register a labor that comes into a country.
That does come later. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. But I was just that something I don't know triggered hearing communist bloc. Why?
Mm-hmm. What? I was like, what? It's like,
and then we get a so the truck goes off the main highway and it is rolling through the countryside.
We have some banter from the crew basically, and I think this is where Noah is you know, why are we waiting so long? Why can't we just like take on this truck right now? We know where it is, and they're like, we can't involve civilian traffic. You're starting to sound like Goda.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you just
you're starting to sound like Oda. Sound like Oda, who's the hothead. Yeah.
And he's like, what do you mean by that? You just hear that off camera.
Yeah, I didn't realize their lines of communication are open. But yeah, they funnel the runaway truck and that contains a demo labor to the entrance of a tunnel. And they try to blockade it from getting into the tunnel. And at this point, the driver, we get a wonderful reveal. We get to a cut to the inside of the cab and he goes, yes. Oh my God, this is just a truck. Why is everybody so mad at me? Right? Why are they making such a big deal out of this? So that's the moment we realize the driver has no theological
no philosophical, ideological. Like I have no,
he doesn't know what's even in the truck.
He doesn't know what's in the truck.
I have no stake in this. I don't know what the fuck's going on.
I feel like it's also helps like tonally to know that he talks like, why does everyone care so much about this truck? It's like, why?
Because you stole it and it was already like stolen. He doesn't know that.
Like out of his element.
Yeah.
So yeah, this guy's completely in over his head and it's so funny. Right in that moment, the labor that is in the cab of the truck wakes up, whips its arms.
Oh, actually we get a whole lead up to that.
Yeah.
And what's funny is what's even funnier about the reveal of who's driving it is it comes right before another like sex scene of this truck driving. And we think we're going to get like, who was the badass who stole a truck that was stolen?
Yeah, that's so funny.
Why is everyone so mad at me? And it's like, and then, yeah. So their plan is two laborers at the tunnel entrance, Oda and Noah. And the plan is basically just to, you know, box them in. You can't keep driving past them. They have a tunnel. They know they can like prevent anything. They can kind of control the situation better here. And basically just because of like, they're not the best at teamwork. I think these two, as we've seen since the very first episode, you know, they try to stop it. And then you're right, Pat, an arm rips out the side of the truck. And again, the driver we know has no idea what's going on. So we're even kind of surprised by this. That causes the two Pat laborers to like not know what's going on because, oh my God, an arm just ripped out of this truck. And that gives the truck driver enough of a chance to like drive past them. And then as it's driving into the tunnel, the robot comes completely alive, sheds the skin of the truck. And my first thought was that is one sick looking demo labor.
It looks really cool.
I love that it has the word shaft on its chest. It is like the most badass thing. I'm just like, shaft. I was like, my first thought was like, oh, like the anime studio. And I was like, oh, like the blaxploitation film. Oh, like the company that built this thing.
Yes, it was built by Shaft Enterprises Europe, which we learned a little bit later. But yeah, the sequence of the truck. Go ahead.
No, I was also going to say the labor also looks kind of like Samus. I'm not sure why.
It does.
But it looks a bit like her power armor.
Yeah,
its design is distinct from like all of the other the Shinohara Heavy Industry builds that we've seen so far.
And you're supposed to be like, that's a demo
right.
labor. Like
that's a badass looking demo labor. Why don't we get those?
It's also red.
Police?
I guess we didn't say like it's bright sports car red. Like
right,
bright sports car red.
Right.
So the Pat Labors give chase into the tunnel, and but then the animation sequence of this thing waking up while moving in the tunnel is so sick. So it just, it's on the bed of the remains of a flatbed truck that is still cruising down this tunnel, and it just lowers its feet onto the asphalt, and it's just sparking and dragging these feet, and then it like sits up like Frankenstein, on the bed of this truck. But then it doesn't confront them in the tunnel. It just keeps driving, and because our heroes fuck everything up again.
Yeah.
Because Oda, who has chased him into the tunnel and fired a warning shot at the truck or missed while shooting at the truck, then stands up too fast, forgetting that he's in a tunnel, and smashes the skull and the head of his labor and blocks the tunnel so they can't get around him in the tunnel in time.
Forgot.
So that's so wonderful, and it matters to the rest of the episode. This is when they have to break off their pursuit, because there's that line right before that happens where they're like, get the trucks in there, pick them up, let's go, and then he's like, okay.
Yep. So then it gets away, and I think when it picks up, we're actually with the clueless truck driver.
Yes.
And who we now kind of can figure out is whoever was piloting that red Pat Labor, or I guess that red, we think still demo labor.
Yeah.
And this, we kind of realize because of what he's talking about, that this is a Beach House member, terrorist.
Mm, yes.
Freedom fighter, whatever. And he is, just tries to, even he's realized that this is not the right driver, and he's trying to recruit him. He's basically like, you are a worker, you are a laborer, because that we learn that this guy's
you're a temporary seasonal worker, you're just like us. You're pliable to the schemes of the government. I'm like,
the dude. Pause in this joke is so funny. The part where he says, the driver who stole the truck says, I'm just a seasonal worker, I don't know what's going on. Yeah. And he goes, you're a seasonal worker? You're an ally.
And then there's another joke that literally falls right up here, this where the pilot is just like, our dawn is fast approaching, and he points somewhere and he's like, that's west. That's not where the dawn comes from.
So it's important to note again that these guys aren't even Beach House, or this is a Beach House sympathizer group. So this is a group that is so excited about the goals of the eco-terrorist group, anti-government group Beach House, that they've made their own sort of fan group, which I think is sort of like why they're played as extra incompetent in this episode.
Yeah.
So they are sticking together there under the overpass. And then we have some fun scenes of, you know, all the classic Pat Labor characters bickering about how that went wrong.
And that leads us to like part of this that just makes it even more kind of typical Pat Labor shit. And it's great. Mm-hmm. So they understand, they find out now that the labor is not what it's supposed to be, obviously. Yes. Because the manufacturer CSEE, which is like,
Shaft. I'm trying to
remember, it's like
Shaft Enterprises Europe.
And there's an interesting wrinkle to this where, okay, it's dramatic. Mm-hmm. This is SV-1 Nagumo landing like in a helicopter with some military general guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he walks up and he's like, thanks for being on this. We're going to have you coordinate with the manufacturer, who is so upset about how this happened. They're so sorry. They want to help you clean it up. And, you know, they kind of prefer if it's not like a huge deal, doesn't get in the news. You know, we'll just keep this between us. It's very obvious that there's something fishy about this setup.
Because yes, yeah.
Why would the corporation that at this point we now understand actually smuggled this thing in? It was supposed to be a demo labor in that container for a industry show. And now we found out actually they were transporting a military labor. That's smuggling, and it's weird that you're letting the people who just smuggled something illegally help you fix the problem.
Sounds like the military-industrial complex is just sort of pocketing some ill-gotten gains in order to turn a blind eye. It's like, okay, cool.
There are two things that I really liked about this scene. One of them is in the background, they have the laborers back on their pallets, on the back of their flatbed trucks, and one of the laborers is comically squashed because
that's Oda's. that's Oda's work.
And the other thing was the really funny prolonged look that Gota and Nagumo share after this guy tells them that they'll be getting some assistance with the operation. And I still don't know what that smile means. They just look at each other for a long time and then they both smile.
It's definitely those two characters. Like, this is a personal joke, and then they've been through this before. And obviously Godo figures it out immediately. He's like, oh, they're not here to help us. They're trying to cover their tracks.
Yes.
So we're not here just to recover the stolen smuggled labor. We're also here to make sure that the evidence is preserved.
Right. But Shaft does catch up with the red labor before them. The red hijacked labor is on the run still when it is waylaid by two very, very Gundam-y looking.
They're Zakus.
They look like Zakus. Like, yeah.
And that's gotta be a tribute. I mean, we know how much the makers of this love anime.
It's these cyclopic,
green, beefy military mechs are there to intercept the red mech as it's running away. And they give chase, and our Pat Labor buddies show up at the same time too. Mm-hmm. I missed something. Something very important that happens.
Yes.
When they get knocked off the road, the driver, the beach house sympathizer, is injured. And he says to the truck driver, man, you got to go on in my stead. You got to complete our mission. Our allies are waiting for us. And the truck driver's like, yeah, sure, man, pretty much. And just takes the guy out of the Pat Labor and gets in it so that he can keep running away.
I'll take it back when I'm done. Okay. I got somewhere to be. Like, that's right, really what it is.
Yeah. He's like, I'll bring it back when I'm done.
Yeah.
And it's sick. As soon as he gets in this mech, he knows what to do with it. They have the throwaway line of like, oh, just like the one I use at work.
Yeah. So maybe it is a demo mech. Maybe it is a demo labor. I don't know.
But we get our first little bit of robot fighting here. And it's just he catches the foot of one of these SE mechs that's attempting to stomp on his head. He catches the foot, shoves it off into the other one, and then makes a run for it.
And then this is where SV2 shows up. It's not long after. They kind of are tracking where they're headed and they're ready for them. And they set up Noah taking point. Because again, she's got to do it all herself. She's essentially got to capture one and take on two. And she is ready for it. Red runs up to them and is running. So it's not like really interested in fighting them. And I feel like they just kind of like get in the way of it. And they're like, we're going to help you. And he's like, okay.
Yeah.
And so Noah's like, this is now under our jurisdiction, our control. We have it from here. They don't like that, though.
Yeah. If you interfere, you will be interfering with an official, like, investigation up to this point. And they're just like, nah, fuck it. I got a mission. I got to do something. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember how exactly they put it. Yeah, but.
I actually watched the sub of this episode instead of the dub.
Yeah.
They don't say anything in the one that I watched. Noah throws the first punch on Godo's order, which is really funny. So the way it plays out in the sub episode is Godo gets on the intercom and says, like, reinforces the point Noah just made, saying like, we need you guys to stand down right now. They just kind of stand there for a second. They don't do anything.
They didn't say anything in the dub version either.
I was like, I can't think of what they did say. I think they just kind of like stood there like intimidatingly.
But then Godo's like, and I guess they're not going to listen, so go ahead and take them out.
And I mean, like, it's a sick labor-on-labor fight. It's all we've ever wanted. Yep. They don't hold back.
It's the first use, I think, of the baton that she draws from behind the shield in the arm.
Don't they briefly use that in their training fight?
Maybe they do, yeah.
I think so, yeah. But this is the first time we've seen it in action against not another Pat Labor, but, like, an actual adversary and opponent. Yeah.
Right.
And it's a tough fight. Again, these are seemingly military, so she's already kind of outgunned. Mm-hmm. And I like how it's staged in the sense that it's not, it's not like you're always wondering where's the other one and why isn't it helping? She's able to kind of like throw one off for a sec, fight with another. It's still like they take it seriously or logistically.
Yeah.
And clearly, she's not winning, like, after a little while.
Right. They establish right before the fight kicks off that these two units would definitely win in a sort of standing slugfest. So she needs to rely on the fact that her pat labor is faster and more responsive than theirs to overcome them in this fight. And to your point about them treating this like it's real, I do really like that it has elements of these are humanoid robots fighting kind of like humans, but they are still doing things that literally just make sense for robots to do. For example, when the way she uses the baton isn't just to bludgeon these robots, she uses it to jam into the mechanical groin joint of one of the other robots and sort of pry the parts in there to do some damage to the mechanics of it. It's just like a really cool, thoughtful thing in imagining how a fight would go down when you're trying to disable another mechanical thing, even if it is like a big human-shaped thing.
I think she's eventually thrown on her back, and then one of them, they like kind of get right up next to her and they're about to stomp on her and just, you know, it doesn't seem like it's good for her. When our truck driver comes in and says, I'm the kind of guy who pays his debts.
Yep.
So good. Yeah. One of the two Brockens is the name of the model of the
combat. Oh, yeah. They do mention him. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He's like winding up in the classic like overhead double axe handle strike. And he's about to come down. And then, oh, our trucker caught him, catches the fist. Yeah. And, God, this next part is so good. I audibly smiled and laughed and gasped when this happened.
Yeah.
Because at this point now, it's not only are they like equally matched, but they're like off tilt. Like it felt like they actually used how this would be surprising and destabilizing, and then very quickly they're able to just kind of like cut them down.
It almost feels like a punchline, like a final release to how little combat there has been in this show, because we just had that example of how, you know, practical the fight is. They do pro wrestling.
That's true.
Noah is enraged. She grabs one of these military mechs by the arm, giant swings him around in an Irish whip, throws him. They do a classic tag team move. They do an Irish whip into a clothesline, and the driver of the mech explicitly yells clothesline as he's doing it.
What did Noah say when she was doing the whole swing around? It's like, I think for the dub is like, you hurt my patty or something like that. And I was like,
she did. Yes.
It's like, I thought she would have called her pat labor Alphonse, or it was like, you hurt my Alfie or whatever. But like, that makes sense.
It's kind of like saying you hurt my kitty or something. It's like, you hurt my baby.
It's a cute diminutive name for her giant robot. Yeah. But and that last freeze frame of the military mech just running into the demo mech's clothesline, just freeze frame in this beautiful field as these, bits of flour are drifting in the air. It's gorgeous.
What is that called? It's called a photograph memory. And I think that it was coined by, it was the director of The Rose of Versailles and of, let me look this up for a sec. Let me look this up 1 second, because this This is gonna bother me if I don't.
It's you're talking about that animation technique where
it's a still frame and then it goes into sort of like this chalk sort of like outline or whatever.
Is that is that referencing like those old wood prints style?
I think it is sort of like that. It's meant to just like emphasize that this is like a very dramatic point. Rose of Versailles. Osamu Dezaki, Dezaki, and he's known for the snapshot memories, which are basically pastel freeze frames that he called postcard memories. That's what it's called. Yeah, postcard memories that uses
we
like
full
frames.
Yeah. It's I love those scenes in any anime where it's like they freeze it and they, you know, it's either fully hand painted or there's like more layers of shading than they have budget for and the moving animation and stuff. But yeah, we end on a beautiful one of those of two robots doing pro wrestling on each other in a field. And that brings us to our labor point.
Oh,
this is a thing that I've talked about at length in the past, the Pro Wrestling Union. Doesn't exist.
No, it doesn't.
So, pro wrestling is a strange world. It is a world of storytellers. So, getting good information on this stuff is really hard. Most of what we have is from shoot interviews, which are interviews where pro wrestlers are paid to sit down and just talk about their careers and their lives and their encounters with other wrestlers and backstage stories in out of character. Shoot. It is not a shoot is the opposite of work, which is what we call the fiction of pro wrestling. But there is enough to go on to pretty definitively say that the best attempt at unionizing professional wrestling was squashed by the vile Vince McMahon in the 1980s.
And not just Vince McMahon.
Yeah, he had some help.
But also, oh yes, he had some help.
A dirty, no good grasshopper dick. to quote the Iron Sheik, or the Iron Sheik social media account, which I don't think was run by the Iron Sheik. But yeah, Hulk Hogan snitched.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, pretty much in the run up to, I believe it was WrestleMania 2.
What year is that?
That's, I think, 84. Let me confirm. Okay.
Pat, I have to ask, are you referring to that Vince McMahon storybook that like was published? I'm trying to think about what was it called.
No, this is story initially entered the public awareness during the, and let me verify this, I believe it was during the sort of discovery and the trial around steroid use in in the WWE, which was in the early 90s, which was around the time they introduced their wellness policy, which was this system that they could use to do random drug tests on people and then suspend or fire them if they're found to have like elevated testosterone or steroids or any other drugs in their system. But within the one of the many wonderful times Vince McMahon was under oath in court, the line of questioning turned to the unionization effort led by Jesse the Body Ventura and how he found out about that and started, you know, putting a bit of pressure on people not to get on board with it under threat of firing or just sort of, you know, sort of internal punishment that would happen.
Do you want to give a quick rundown of, like,
yeah,
before yes. a union starts without yes. telling management, usually for reasons
yes.
that you will seem very evident soon, people who want to do a union will kind of clandestinely talk to other people and just be like, yes. hey, we're thinking about starting a union. Would you be interested? And if you get to a like, yes, I'm interested. In fact, I support this. You kind of get them to, it's not always this way, but card check is like one of these ways of like sign a card that basically just says, I will join a union if we announce we're doing a union. It's basically, you want to know you have a lot of numbers before you go to the boss and say, we're unionizing. It's like, it's in fact, you want to get like the vast majority, or you might have a hard time, especially if you've yes. asked everyone and a lot of those were like, I don't know, not for me. You've kind of got to do this pre-work, this pre-planning, and it's clandestine. Like, you are, especially in the shops that are very against it, mm-hmm. you have to do it this way, as we'll soon see.
mm-hmm. Yeah, so this story begins for Jesse Ventura as he's kicking off he's right at the cusp of kicking off his film career. And there's a lot of stuff in this story of where you see examples of not great solidarity mm-hmm. on either front. And it's also, again, as I mentioned earlier, it's hard to get really, really good information on this stuff. The story, as Jesse tells it, is that he was in an elevator with the head of the WWF, but the NFL's union, at this time period, I forget his name. And that guy says to him, you guys need to get a union. And he's like, yes, we do. Why do they need a union? Because professional wrestlers at this point in history, for all of history and still now, have been generally paid and hired as independent contractors. You might look at an organization like the WWE and you've got John Cena over there and you've got, I don't know who's big these days. You've got all these top guys over at the company. And you might think, okay, they work for WWE. They are WWE employees. I don't see them doing shows elsewhere. I don't see them working the indies. I don't see them showing up at conventions, running their own booths and stuff to sell their own t-shirts. They must work for the company. No, they don't. They're independent contractors. But they're often, those independent contracts usually have really, really strict no-compete stuff in them, which is kind of the opposite of how an independent contract should work. And that is how it's always been. It is a system where the power is completely centralized in the company leadership, and everybody below a certain line is treated as completely disposable.
So it's a situation that basically gives off this sort of outward impression of being employed by this company and being employed in good faith when in fact they are being treated as like independent contractors and like being paid less than what one expect. It feels like kayfabe, but for employment. I'm not really big into wrestling, but from what I understand, this is kayfabe, but for employment purposes.
More or less, that's a really good description of it.
Yeah,
I don't want to speak out of turn on what I know that the majority of, I believe most of these contractors don't have insurance through the WWE. Sometimes they'll have other arrangements though, where it's like, if you have a injury and you have surgery while on your WWE contract, they will pay for your medical treatment in your time there. But there is no, you know, there are no days off. There is no vacation schedule. There's no PTO schedule there. They don't have any of the stuff, the guarantees and the safeties that you get as a full-time employee, let alone a union employee. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty easy for them to sever a contract.
And I think they also, like, in that way that they can't sell their own t-shirts, their character essentially is like owned by WWE. So if they leave, I think in some cases they don't even get to use their name as their wrestling name. Like, it's,
that's right. Sometimes these independent contracts include handing over a name or your name, whatever it is, some sort of stage name, which means that if you then go out and do your own thing afterwards, you either need to come up with a new name and persona or fight the company for the right to take your name with you.
Are there any like prominent examples of that where it's like a really famous, like, I'm sure there are. It's like, I just don't know this myself. It's like of a very famous wrestler with a very like well-known ubiquitous name who then had to like leave and they had to like rebrand themselves because they had to compete over the brand of their own persona.
So one interesting one is, let's say, Razor Ramon. You remember Razor Ramon? He was only Razor Ramon in the WWE. When he jumped ship and went over to the WCW, he, you know, probably for the better, dropped the fake Cuban accent and just became the guy who he was, Scott Hall, because he couldn't be Razor Ramon over there. I'm trying to think of another example. So part of the same sort of exit from WWF was Diesel. Big Daddy Cool. What's his real name though? How could I forget my beloved's name? The guy who's in the Super Shredder suit in the end of Ninja Turtles 2. Hang on.
I personally think that Scott Hall is cooler than Razor Ramon.
I agree. Kevin Nash. Also played the Russian in the Punisher movie.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Yeah, he's the one guy John Wick doesn't kill in John Wick 1. He's guarding the Red Circle Club, and he's John Wick comes in. He's like, "You've lost some weight," and he's like, 40 kilos." Not really Russian. Anyways,
I didn't know that. That's awesome.
This episode had 2 seconds of pro wrestling in it, so I wanted to talk about the Pro Wrestling Union.
Yes.
So what happens is Jesse Ventura does some preliminary work talking to other people in the locker room, seeing if they would be interested in unionizing for better benefits, better pay. The amount of traction he gets is unclear. His testimony on the situation is that leading up to WrestleMania, he's pushing for a work stoppage, saying, he gets up in front of the locker room and says, "Hey, if we all right now threaten to not go out and do this massive show, we will have an incredible amount of leverage to barter for ourselves here." This is not probably how you actually get a union done, but it's a move towards collective action. In the whether or not it would have worked, we don't know, because the report is that Hulk Hogan snitches on the operation. Vince McMahon applies pressure. People die back away from this effort, and then another sort of failure of solidarity is in this shoot interview. Jesse Ventura says something really funny, which is he's sort of bitter about about the lack of support that he got from other wrestlers. But then he gets a role in Predator, so he enters the Screen Actors Guild, and now he has his insurance and he has his benefits. And he says something along the lines of like, "Well, I got my union now, so screw you guys."
Oh my God. Wow.
So he doesn't really push on it after that. But the kind of shocking thing is that the conditions have really only marginally improved for professional wrestlers. They're still working most days out of the year on a really brutal road schedule. Mm. They're getting a lot of injuries. They are extremely prone to being cut from their contracts if they, you know, take steroids to recover from an injury or to stay insanely jacked so that they can keep getting booked. And there have been no successful efforts since. And that's a bummer.
Mm-hmm. And we even have, I mean, I know that you mentioned the two different wrestling organizations that eventually joined or were bought out, mm-hmm. and became one. And it feels like that's obviously when the time when the most power would be in Vince McMahon's hands, things got worse. But then maybe in part because AEW has given sort of another option out there.
Yes.
If there are marginal improvements, like part of it is just because there is actually a feasibly another place they can go, but that's still, yes, like not the same. That's not anywhere near the same as like my employer respects me and gives me,
right,
benefits. And
yeah, I think that is worth noting that I think a lot of people who then got AEW contracts, so AEW is the closest thing to a competitor now. Mm. A lot of them were able to negotiate non-exclusivity, right? Mm-hmm. So, and they also don't have the same absolutely brutal road schedule that the WWE has. So if you're an AEW wrestler, there's a much better chance that you can go do weekend gigs for yourself at local indies or super indies. As long as you're not wrestling for the big main competitor, you can still make your own money. You can go sell your own t-shirts, right? You still have the opportunities that one would associate with being a freelancer.
Right.
And you're not necessarily completely locked to a single employer as a self-employed person. So that's the wrestling union, wrestling labor. It's fucked. I don't know how to fix it.
The fight goes on. The fight continues.
But there's a lot. I don't feel like I've been top smart today, but there's a couple of good pieces of reading here that I'll drop in the chat, and maybe we can put these in the show notes from Grantland, New York Times, and a really good write-up from the NYU Law Journal.
Yeah, I'll definitely throw those in there because I know that story is wild, and mm-hmm. Vince McMahon is a terrible human being.
All-time piece of shit.
All-time. Yeah. Maybe a little interesting for some of those evil reasons, but like, he can't die soon enough. Anyway, we have a little bit more of this episode though to talk about.
Yes, I'm sorry that our big diversion.
No. I love that big diversion.
It's always fun. What is Pat gonna? Well, we got this obvious one with the migrant workers and labor conditions for like, mm-hmm. and there's another one coming up here, which is this reveal might have been the part where I'm like, okay, I like this episode a lot more now because it felt like there was a point to it.
Yes. Right.
And that is, we figure out why this trucker was trying to get home so fast, why he was willing to steal a truck to do it. His wife was pregnant.
Oh.
Yeah.
And she just had the baby, and the baby's so cute and it's tucked.
There's another way to say that.
What?
His wife was in labor. Do you think that's something they thought about at all?
I don't know, dude.
Oh my god, that's amazing. I love that. I love that shit.
Clayton, this is why you're the goat.
Oh my god, that's
especially
awesome.
Especially because it's not just, that's not the only reason that they brought in this plot line of like, this guy was trying to get home so fast because his wife was pregnant. And that's a very human reason. It's unpredictable. It's why mm-hmm. everyone was just kind of puzzled by this.
Right.
But it's very genuine. It's very human. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Godo starts talking with Nagumo about how, like, he did steal a truck. Like, or Nagumo mm-hmm. is kind of pointing this out. Like, you know, he's in a big trouble. And Godo's like, you know, if we just mention that the other guy stole it and he's the only guy who ever did steal it, then this guy doesn't have to get in trouble. And again, just the way they kind of talk about this, you can kind of already tell that, like, or she says, like, you just want to cover it up. All right.
It's like, whose word are you going to take? Are you going to take my word? Or are you going to take this beach house, like, member's word? Like, what's going to happen?
She points out, like, he'll testify about, like, the fact this other dude stole it. And it's like, who's going to believe him?
Yeah.
Again, and Godo's right, like, people be lazy. Like, the cops won't look too hard into it if they just say what happened. or they are the cops in this case. I don't know.
Right.
But the thing that's interesting here, Godo being like, come on, you want to see the baby? And she's like, I'm not interested in babies.
Yeah.
Okay. We know there's something between the two of them.
Yes. Yes, and there is.
This is where I really think that this would have been a strong thing to have before the two-parter, because then Nagumo and Odo's relationship is that more interesting, which you literally have this point where he is like, hey, it'd be nice to have kids someday. And she's like, not for me.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And that puts all their little, like, okay, they obviously like each other.
Will they? Won't they? I don't know. It's like,
he
it's
seems
sort of
to like her in a different way that she likes him.
It's always been hovering there in the background for the entire arc of the series in just one or two ways, just one way how they quip against one another. But, like, yeah, I see your point now. I see your point, Clayton. Yeah.
It's not a huge thing. It was in fact, the only thing that I was a little puzzled by this one was like, why was this one last? And I think your points are all very valid and probably the reason. Also, I'm curious if you know anything about this, Toussaint, and this was released on VHSs, right?
I believe, yes, this was released on VHSs because this is, that's the format of OVAs. Like, they would produce these and they would sell them in stores, and that's how they made, like, back their money for that.
Was it one episode at a time?
That is a good question.
Because we're going to talk about the season.
I want to say it's usually like two episodes. It's usually two episodes at a time. Like, this is what I'm familiar with when it comes to OVAs from back in that era. But, shit. How much are you going to really pay? You're going to pay like $30, $40 for one episode of Pat Labor? Like, come on, man.
It's an odd number, too. So I'm like.
Right.
But the economics of it, I know, just this is just what I know from the behind the scenes of like Evangelion, for example, is that they didn't have budget for like the next couple of episodes. They were like it was going practically an episode at a time, what they could produce work wise and also what they had money for. And then money dries up. And so the ending isn't what you thought it would be. And I'm curious if there's anything here to like, oh, we did six episodes, but actually people really like this. Let's do a seventh that's like kick-ass.
So I'm looking at the Wikipedia right now. The series was released straight to VHS and Laserdisc from April 25th, 1988 to June 25th, 1989. So we got the first episode came out in April. Okay. The next one is June, July, September, November. I think you're right. I think they did actually release these episodes like individually on VHS, and Laserdisc.
We don't know necessarily the production order. Like, were they funding like two episodes ahead based on how the first like?
Yeah, I'd have to look that up.
When we're talking about the whole season, we might talk about more of that stuff and like the order. But I mean, I'd say overall, the short of it is I think we all loved this OVA and it was really good.
Fucking great. This is a great show. I'm so happy. Yeah.
Like, I'm really happy we watched this. Do we want to?
And I got to learn about labor history.
A tiny bit. I'm doing my best over here. I think you're doing great.
Thank you. I think you're doing great.
Are we doing a season recap as part of the same episode, or are we doing that as a separate thing?
We're going to do a bonus. So look out for that in our bonus tier. Reminder, you can also get a video version of the episodes where we talk a little bit extra about stuff and show and tell a little bit by subscribing to one of Rogue's higher tiers. So check that out. We appreciate all our subscribers, and you'll be hearing that fairly soon. But then the next regular episode will be Pat Labor. Pat Labor the movie.
Yeah.
So yeah, until next time, unless you're sticking around, this has been Pat's Labor. I'm Clayton Ashley.
I'm Toussaint Egan.
And I'm Pat Labor.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.